This conference is being recorded.
Okay, the wonders of modern technology. Hello, everyone. Let's everyone say hello to your grounding. If you're female, please be female grounded. Some of you folks who are listening have not been here for quite some time, and there may even be some of you who don't know how to female ground. So let me just quickly cover that again without a comprehensive discussion of why we female ground. I'll leave that for a class. But to female ground, you have your regular grounding cord going into the base of your spine, a nice big grounding cord about the size of your hips. And you then continue, you have little continuations of that cord or little tributaries go up to each ovary, to your uterus, and to the sciatic nerve in the back, in your back, about where the sacrum is, and running down into your legs and feet, and where you ground that is at the sacrum. So it looks a little bit like tributaries coming into the Mississippi. The Mississippi being your grounding cord, and the extensions from each ovary, uterus, and sciatic nerve being rivers like the Ohio or Missouri that pour into the Mississippi. Okay, very good. Now, this is mostly going to be channeled. We'll take quite frequent breaks, and we'll go for a total of 3 hours now, and then 3 hours after lunch for a total of six. What we're going to cover is the seven planes of consciousness after the fashion first a kind of synthesis of Western and Eastern approaches first generated by Madame Blavatsky, the founder of Theosophy. And adapted and made somewhat easier to understand by later Theosophists towards the end of the 19th century and the early 20th century. There are several excellent books on this by mostly by a guy named Ledbetter. And then there's a series on several of the various planes. Those books are published by the Theosophical House. And probably if you do a search, you can find those various books. All those books, though, have a serious drawback, and the drawback is that they're just loaded with a Victorian era perspective. They're filled with descriptions of what one might find if one is capable of achieving those energies. There's no information at all about how to achieve those energies. So for the last 100 years, there have been a few psychics at various places who've been able to operate in one or more of the various planes. A few classes that utilize these concepts. But I don't have the sense that there's any place where you've been able to systematically find the various planes and subplanes accurately and easily. In a group. Now, one more thing to say about that. As we said in the blurb for the class, the style of clairvoyance really shifted in people educated from about the 60s on. So past the 60s, there were a few people who had been educated earlier who continued to see in that style, in the older style. But most, though not all, clairvoyants centered their clairvoyance on the chakra and the aura. Rather on the chakra system and the aura rather than on the planes of consciousness. And in the chakra and the aura, for reasons that we probably won't go into, very technical reasons, the orientation, the perception that was generated has a distinctly astral cast to it. Now, the advantage of this style is that it, or several of this new style, the most and the two most important are that it's a very this life oriented perceptual scheme, so that modern clairvoyants tend to be very focused in on this life issues. And the second is because it's located in the chakras and the auras, in layers of the auras, it's a very usable system. So rather than just having a lot of exhortations about this and about that, people actually learn to be working psychics. Now again, there have been schools over the last 30 years, a couple of which I'm aware of, that use the terminology of the old theosophist or Alice Bailey, who took up beginning in 1919 and wrote until about 1953, I think, from the so-called Tibetan. And some of them have been fairly sophisticated. I just don't have the sense that they have an easy, practical style of communicating to people how to find these levels. While there are great advantages to the aura and chakra based clairvoyance that we've cultivated and continue to cultivate, One downside of working with the chakras is that you can meet the chakras at different energy levels, different frequencies. This is kind of confusing, but in each layer, the same chakra vibrates differently. And you can get lost in chakras, and you can go very deeply into chakras and come out a rabbit hole in an entirely different place. So while there are various schemas that will say that you find, say, the mental plane in the third layer of your aura, I find those very unsatisfactory. The advantage of the seven planes, each with seven subplanes, is that you have a very precise scale of energies. Now, of course, nothing is ever really that simple. And in our monthly classes on the third Wednesday of every month, which this month will be very soon. It'll only be about, it'll be this Wednesday will be the third Wednesday, I think. We're going to take this lovely synthesis of the late Victorians and introduce a lot of Sethian concepts and explorations. So now let's start in a description of, there are several advantages then of having a nice simple scale with 49 frequencies. And probably the most significant advantage is that you can find very precisely the energy of that part of your soul which is most oriented towards your individual physical life. The soul is huge and has activities that are going on simultaneously with what you think of as yourself, that are going on simultaneously in other dimensions. So right now, your soul is interacting with full consciousness, even more consciousness than you have, what you think of as you, is interacting with other souls and you know, the solar system and who knows what else. So in other dimensions, other parts of you, in particular the soul, are doing very complex and rich experiences. So what you think of as you is just one player in a grand scheme of you that's doing all kinds of things. But the part of the soul that we will spend a lot of time getting in touch with today is the part that oversees your human incarnation as an individual. It's not the most transcendental part of you. It's the most eternally individuated part of you. And so from the point of view of Western orientation to mystical reality, your soul is in some ways more important than the unity level, the more transcendental mystical level that is the object of particularly Hindu mysticism. And the reason it's more important is because the soul is the part that's eternal and individuated and constantly growing and expanding. In our system, we have a different relationship to experience than a lot of mystical approaches. And the relation and that difference is a profoundly consequential difference. One of the most important differences is how we treat, for example, emotion. A lot of systems will tell you around emotion, even a lot of the old theosophical literature talks about transcending emotions, and if you have, and talks about canceling negative emotions and substituting positive emotions and dissolving negative emotions, whereas the system that I've been trained in treats every experience as not only sacred, but as an eternal resource. And every experience is to be assimilated, not dissolved or abandoned or transcended. And that assimilation process takes place ultimately at the soul, in collaboration with the physical body. And that assimilation experience requires that you be capable of validating your experience and letting go of your resistance to your experience. Now, that can sound like a perfect picture, and I don't think you have to do it perfectly. But it is a profoundly different approach to life. So when you have a so-called negative emotion like anger, instead of substituting another emotion, instead of dissolving the anger, you own the anger, you validate the anger, and in a two-step process, the first part of the process is to decide how to deal with your anger in the moment as resourcefully as you can. That may involve telling someone you're too angry to continue right now. It might lead you to be appropriately forceful or appropriately assertive. There are all kinds of things. It's so-called negative emotions will naturally carry you forward to do. It's just often hard to do them skillfully. So in the moment, you act as skillfully as you are capable of at that moment. Then the second part of how you deal with the so-called negative emotion is later at your leisure, you do the various kinds of cognitive and psychic spiritual work to broaden the context, to understand where whose energy were you using, what pictures you were stuck on, what shoulds, have-tos, and oughts were motivating, were generating your emotions, and doing the work so that the next time you encounter that situation, you'll still have the capacity to be angry, because that's a very useful ability, but you may respond somewhat more resourcefully and somewhat more playfully. Now, that approach arises from a deep, fundamental, soul-based orientation. And that approach arises from a commitment to engage every experience in your life as if it were sacred and meaningful, maybe not in the moment, but in a way that you can assimilate that experience and it becomes part of the core of the soul, and the soul itself expands as a result of its engagement with physical reality, because it has more experience about what it's like to be a human being engaging various kinds of situations. The Aquarian Age, so the Piscean Project is for mankind to engage the world sufficiently complexly that the souls of mankind become sufficiently knowledgeable and complex and stable and robust to be able to engage in a new level of intimacy that goes beyond what any person, no matter how magnificent, the Dalai Lama, Amici, Jesus Christ, the Buddha, there's a certain kind of intimacy that even they have not been capable of, because the context for that kind of intimacy requires a critical mass of human beings with souls that are sufficiently stable and robust. A shorthand term for that would be playful or amused, to engage in an interrelated soul consciousness where there's both an aware uniqueness on the part of the soul and an interrelationship at a level of particularity and intimacy that is new. And that is the kind of thing that will be emerging, and that's Madhuji's project, as she begins to generate what she's calling a pre-group consciousness. That's a precursor of the Aquarian Age. So that's, I think, really the most profoundly important part of this system is the accuracy with which you can get in touch with that part of the soul which is most physically directed. Most of the time when I see people talk about the soul, they are in fact talking about a set of aspirations, or a set of perfect pictures that vibrate usually in the first subplane of the astral plane, occasionally a little higher into the mental plane. So now we'll talk about a description of the seven planes themselves. These seven planes are the seven planes of human consciousness. Within the theosophical scheme, those seven planes of human consciousness together form the lowest plane of what might be called cosmic consciousness. And in a nice Western sort of way, the progress continues, and there are larger and larger fields of consciousness. I find that very appealing. There's a mystical tradition that that a human being can touch the ground of all being and become one with the universe. While that's obviously true, I don't personally believe that a human being can do that in the same way that, say, our sun is at one with the whole universe. I just think that there's a significant way in which the sun is operating in ways that no human being can operate. Even if the human being experiences himself or herself at one with the sun and identical with the sun, I personally choose to believe that's not as comprehensive as the sun's identity with the sun's experience. But people could argue about that. Okay. So, for the human field of experience, there are seven planes. Two of the seven planes are broken into parts that have separate names. So it can be a little confusing because sometimes people talk about there being nine planes. But in this description, there are seven planes, each with seven subplane levels, just like the white keys on a piano. you'll have an octave, and in an octave there'll be seven notes. The subplanes are smaller frequency separations within the larger octave of a plane. Okay, so the hopefully you have in front of you the schema that Gloria did up and sent around by email. If not, you can get it after the seminar by emailing Gloria, whose email address, by the way, is himshirglow1, that's the numeral 1, at yahoo.com. That's himshirglow1 at yahoo.com. The reason I'm saying this is if you have any questions, you can email them to Gloria during the breaks or especially during lunch. And if some of those questions are of general interest, I'll talk about those questions. Okay, so you start with what we call the physical slash etheric plane, or sometimes I'll reverse the order and say etheric slash physical plane. Oh, and the naming system is not consistent amongst writers. So I've come up with a naming system that appeals to me, that's based primarily on what the late 19th, early 20th century theosophists used as their naming system. But even there are inconsistencies. And I've chosen the one that strikes me as most logical. Okay, so why does the physical plane need the etheric plane? This is actually really cool. Remember that each one of the planes has seven subplanes. And what we call as the physical plane is what we can perceive with our physical senses. What we perceive is made up of the three lowest subplanes of the physical etheric plane. So we live physically in a frequency range that's like the bottom three notes in the physical etheric octave. So there are four notes that are higher that are still in the physical etheric plane. Those, according to my guides, the next one up from the physical plane is where the meridian, where the energy of the meridians lie. The next up from there, according to my guides, is where the energy of the nadis lie. Nadis are what the yogis investigate and utilize for a lot of their meditation and what gets worked on with the various breathing exercises and yoga postures. And people normally assume that those are at the same energy level, but according to my guides, the yoga nadis are at a slightly higher frequency, though within the same octave or plane. Nadis are like psychic blood vessels or nerves. They carry energy throughout your system. Then next above that are the group meridians that go throughout the earth and cross in important places. And then above that would be group nadis. Now the counting scheme that we use is we start from the highest frequency and go down. And in some respects that's kind of illogical. The emotional tendency would be to start from the lowest level and go up, because that's where you start. The reason we start from the highest and number the highest as one is because developmentally the frequencies emerge from the highest frequency and develop down into more and more dense frequencies. So energy moves out from the undifferentiated Tao and becomes the Adi plane, which is the highest plane. And the Adi plane itself starts from the most subtle and then generates seven subplanes and so on. So while I'm going to describe these from the bottom up, they emerge from all that is from the top down, and that's why we do our numbering system that way. Now, on the handout, I think we numbered the planes starting at the physical plane and went up seven. Again, if we were being consistent with that, we'd start with the highest and go down. But for the planes, it doesn't seem to matter to me so much. But for the subplanes, I think it's really useful as an energetic aid to go from the highest frequency subplane as being one to the lowest frequency subplane as being seven. But again, that's purely formal. Okay, so the lowest plane frequency is the etheric physical. Next, you go up to the astral. Now here, this name astral has developed over a period of about 400 years, and its meaning has changed. The word astral itself means starry, and that description was initially applied to the energy of the etheric plane, which to clairvoyance will scintillate. And in fact, if you go outside on a sunny day, you'll see and you look at the air, you'll see several kinds of scintillations. You'll see what Ledbetter used to call energy globules. And they scintillate, and that's that's prana, that's various kinds of vital energy that are in the air, and when you see them, you're actually seeing an energy that isn't physical. And most people will say, oh, that's just a trick your eyes are playing on you. But that, in fact, is a kind of clairvoyance. Sometime in the late 19th century, writers started using the word astral to apply to this next higher plane, the emotional plane. And so most of the books on astral travel are actually talking about emotional travel, though some of the books on astral travel are talking about what I'm calling etheric traveling. Many of you may have read the books of Robert Munro, who started writing in the 70s, about his experience, a book called Journeys Out of the Body. And he spontaneously started having out-of-body experiences. And the ones he first started having were, in fact, the etheric travel, which is very hard to do and very unusual. And later on, he started doing what I would call astral traveling now, or the emotional body traveling. But since Ledbetter and Alice Bailey and so many people over the last 100 years have used astral to refer to the emotional levels, that's the terminology that I use. So the lowest level is the physical etheric. The next level up is the emotional or astral level. The next level up beyond that is again a divided plane. The four lowest subplanes of this plane, which is called the causal mental or the mental causal, the four lowest subplanes are the mental subplanes. Those are the levels at which intellect works. What in the East is called mind with form. And the highest three sublevels are called formless mind, because they're much more subtle and less concrete. So the kind of thinking that goes on in the conventional world, the so-called lower mind, happens in the mental plane. Now, quite wonderful thinking can occur there, and basically most Nobel Prize winners operate out of the mental plane. They may resonate to a concept that comes in from a higher plane, but they tend not to operate in those higher planes. And tend not even to look at those. So someone like Stephen Hawking while he'll channel beings who vibrate much higher, his intellect is working in the mental plane. Okay. Finally, we get to the causal part of the mental causal. And the causal is where that part of the soul which is most directed towards your human individuated experience is located. It's where it camps out lifetime after lifetime until you have finished your physical incarnations, and people who have finished their necessary physical incarnations, the focus of their soul will move up into the next plane in a way that it doesn't for everyone else. Okay, so why is this called the causal plane? The reason this is called the causal plane is because this is where your eternal soul camps out, and this is where your impulse for human experience emerges from, and thus it is the cause of your human experience. This is where you, if you have any karma, any sort of whatever is unique about your soul, generates the impulse of your life as a human being. Now, most people, most of the time, are operating out of lower mental and astral defaults and conditioning, and are not spontaneously and fluidly in alignment with their soul. So that the causation of the soul gets diffused and distorted, and in that way you aren't really elegantly following your own dharma. But when you are in alignment with your soul, you still have a physical, emotional, and mental personality, and it still is the these are still the vehicles through which your soul must find expression. So they still have a creative part to play in the drama. You could say they're the actors and the soul is the playwright. When you are in alignment with your soul, it isn't the case that things will be perfect. It's merely the case that you will be elegantly following your natural dharma or true purpose in life. So the top three subplanes of the causal mental are called the causal, and somewhere on those subplanes is where your soul will be centered. And for most of the people here, it'll be on level one or two. Okay. Now we move up into the higher planes, and not a lot has been done with those most of the time, other than just using them as transcendent expressions. But in point of fact, as we move into the Aquarian Age, we can start to use these higher planes in very specific ways. The next plane up from the causal mental is called the buddhic. The buddhic is a higher octave, a unified ground of being for the emotional or astral plane. One of the things you can do in the buddhic plane is give a kind of healing to your emotions. It's not a substitute for emotions, but it gives when you're in touch with the buddhic, you begin to have a larger point of view with your that you can contextualize your emotions with and become more playful and flowing and elegant with the use of your emotions. It's also the level at which synchronicity emerges. Synchronicity is a non-causal, meaningful relationship, so that when you throw the I Ching, and the I Ching gives you a set of hexagrams that allows you to understand your situation, that grows out of a relationship between the I Ching and you. It doesn't. There's nothing causal there, though. It's not that the I Ching causes your day to turn out the way it is. It's not that you cause the I Ching to turn out the way that the throwing does. It's just that they all happen in synchronistically. So relationship in the buddhic can then become more intimate, because you can be related without intruding in a causal way to someone. So it's a different way of having boundaries. Boundaries that are based upon neutrality, upon neutrality and uniqueness, rather than causality and spatial considerations, which is where we're learning how to set our boundaries now. For the most part, all of us are learning how to set our boundaries in the lower planes. Okay, next above the buddhic plane is the atmic plane. It's a little confusing when you get really spacey. I'll sometimes say adi when I mean atmic. Unfortunately, they both start with A. And adi is the highest plane. Atmic is the fifth highest plane. And the atmic plane is the higher octave of physicality. And in the atmic plane, you can begin to change the laws of physics, and thus you can begin to do miracle healings, and do really wild things. Like there was a great guru in the 1920s, a lady named Ananda Mayama, and she would occasionally be meditating in front of her disciples, and she would start to shrink into a point of light, and then into nothingness, and then start to emerge out of nothingness back as the woman that she was. That occurs at the atmic level. In a more mundane way, you can begin to you can use the atmic level to do very powerful healings in conjunction with clearing pictures and changing beliefs, etc. The next plane up is called the monadic plane, and that's the higher octave of the intellect. So you can do a very powerful healing on anything in the causal mental plane. And finally, and sometimes we don't even get into this range, is the Adi plane. That, I think, is equivalent to the mystical emptiness, the ground of being, the void. I quite frankly don't spend a lot of time there, and I don't know. Sometimes in these classes we go into it and sometimes we don't. I don't have a lot of ways in which I can suggest using that right now. So we may or may not visit that. Okay, so that's a nice full description, I think, of the seven planes, each with seven subplanes. An explanation of why these concepts are useful and important. Now, when we come back from our break, and I think we'll take a good 10-minute break. When we come back from our break, we will start going up and down this energy scale, like a choir singing scales. And it's really quite easy. With enough practice, you begin to know where those notes are. You develop a kind of absolute pitch for this. So if you you can do whatever you want now, and in 10 minutes we'll come back and get started. And this is, by the way, a time if you can run down to your computer, if you have a question, you might try sending it to Gloria, though I don't know that we'll get to the questions themselves until the lunch period. Thank you.